Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC, AM and FM, and WNYC.org. The Supreme Court handed down two major decisions this morning. They ruled the death penalty as unconstitutional in cases of child rape, and they capped the amount that Exxon must pay to compensate victims of the massive 1989 oil spill in Alaska. To discuss these rulings, I'm joined now by Emily Bazelon, a senior editor at Slate.com who covers legal issue. Emily, welcome back to WNYC, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, let's start with Kennedy versus Louisiana, the death penalty case. What was this case about?
This case is about an absolutely horrible crime. It was the rape of an eight-year-old girl by her stepfather, and it was a really brutal rape that did a lot of damage to this child. And so the state of Louisiana has a rare statute in this country that allows the death penalty for child rape, and the stepfather was convicted of the crime and sentenced to death.
And it was ruled unconstitutional because why?
Well, the Supreme Court was looking at its Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, and the Eighth Amendment is the part of the Constitution that prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. And in the last few years, there have been some really interesting cases about what unusual means. And the court has adopted this standard that it calls evolving standards of decency. So it looks at mostly what legislatures have been doing and what they consider to be crimes that are worthy of the death penalty. And in the case of child rape, there are only six states that currently allow for the death penalty for child rape, whereas there are 45 states, plus the federal government, that don't. And so the Supreme Court said that those were small numbers, and that meant that by our current standards of decency, it's going too far to put someone to death for committing child rape.
Now, you... I mean, it's a bit counterintuitive because it does seem to be a pro-death penalty court. What cases do they allow the death penalty for? I mean, is it only murder?
Well, we're getting to that point, although the court was careful to say that it's only limiting the death penalty in cases involving individual murder or crimes against individuals. There's a whole other part of laws in the states and the federal government that prohibit things like treason, you know, crimes that can have implications for lots of people. And so the court's not going there. But they are getting closer and closer to saying that that only murder, only homicide is worthy of the death penalty.
Why is that? I mean, if you believe that the death penalty is a deterrent, why is it that you would say it's only in cases of homicide? What is the thinking behind that?
Well, that's a really good question, and the court talked about it directly this morning. And they talked about one of the problems with exactly what you are deterring. You know, obviously the most straightforward thing that you were probably thinking of was the idea that if people know you can be receive the death penalty for child rape, then they're less likely to commit the crime. But rape is a complicated set of circumstances, and one of the problems with rape is reporting of it, which we know rape is an underreported crime in this country. And that can particularly be true of child rape because, sadly, often the perpetrators are people who know the child or are related to the child. And so there's quite a large problem about whether this crime is committed. And so the court was concerned that the deterrence effect of having the death penalty for the crime could mean even less reporting of child rape.
Does this case have larger implications for the future of the death penalty?
Well, it's an interesting signal about Justice Kennedy, who is still playing the role of swing justice at the court. And Justice Kennedy had written a decision a few years ago outlawing the death penalty for people who commit crimes as juveniles. And that decision was a big move for him to make. It attracted a lot of attention. He got a lot of criticism for it from conservatives. And so we see him today as the fifth vote, as the author again of this opinion, really standing with the same kind of analysis that from that earlier decision, which is this notion that if we have only a handful of states having the death penalty for a particular crime, that's simply not enough. And the slight twist today was that these six states that have passed child rape death penalty laws have done so quite recently. And so the question was, well, are we seeing a change in direction toward more prohibition of child rape, more allowing the death penalty for this crime? Is that where the trajectory is growing? And Kennedy said these numbers are simply too small, and this number of only a handful of states is not enough. But
that seems such a strange standard. I mean, is that common in the Supreme Court, that you say, well, if only a few do it, then it's not right?
Well, no, it's not common, and it is. It can seem odd, but the Eighth Amendment, the words in the Constitution talk about both cruel and unusual. And so the court has taken from that word unusual the notion that it matters a lot what is happening throughout the entire country.
Now, in the case of juveniles, the previous case, there was some criticism for taking into account international standards. Does this decision refer to international standards at all?
No, he didn't go in that direction in this case, really. And it's important to remember that in the earlier case, what happened was that Justice Kennedy pointed out that we were one of very few countries in the world that allowed the death penalty for minors. But he wasn't relying on those court decisions. He was just talking about them as being relevant to this question of evolving standards of decency. But today, the analysis is really contained within the frame of the United States.
So what do the dissenters say?
The dissenters say that there are two problems with Kennedy's opinion. One is that earlier in the 80s, the court wrote a decision that didn't directly prohibit states from making child rape a death penalty crime, but sent them a signal that was a little confusing. And the dissenters think that the states thought they weren't allowed to make this a crime, and that sort of stunted the growth, in Justice Alito's words, of child rape death penalty statutes. And so the dissenters say, look, you know, since states have realized that this is permissible, we already have six doing it, we have more proposed legislation elsewhere, and really the trend, if we allowed it to continue, we would see more states doing this, and we're cutting it off prematurely.
Were you surprised by the fact that the decision was 5-4?
No, I wasn't. I mean, my sense, and I wrote something earlier this week, you know, the notion of a 5-4 split court with Kennedy as a swing voter, I think that is something that's going to remain with us. It hasn't so far this term come up as often as in previous terms, although by the time we're finished with all the decisions coming down on Thursday, we may see the same kind of trend we've seen in previous years. But I think in these contested questions where the justices really do have to figure out standards, they have to inject some part of themselves into it. We have a divided court because we have a divided country. The justices are appointed by presidents. They're not immune to politics and to sort of, you know, political considerations, not in a partisan political way, but simply in terms of what they think is important. And so we see those divisions reflected on the court.
Let's look at the Exxon Valdez case. This had to do with damages awarded in the 1989 oil spill off the coast of Alaska, which was at the time one of the biggest, if not the biggest, environmental disasters in the U.S. What were the details of this decision?
Well, so in this decision, we have Exxon Valdez, and as you were saying, there's this huge oil spill, and there's lots of litigation that come out of it. And we have big awards for compensatory damages, which is, you know, you get money based on the injuries that you've suffered. We have jury awards of $287 million to some of the plaintiffs, and then a settlement for another $22.6 million for other plaintiffs. But then we have this question of punitive damages, and this is the idea that juries can find the conduct of the defendant, Exxon in this case, so horrendous that they want to say, we are punishing you. This isn't to make up for the harm you caused. It's to punish you. It's to send a signal that this is totally unacceptable. And the original punitive damages award in this case was $5 billion. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals cut that down to $2.5 billion. The question today was whether that $2.5 billion award was still excessive, and the court, by a 5-3 ruling, ruled that, yes, in fact, it was, and that the right standard for punitive damages is to reflect the amount of compensatory damages.
That seems really strange. If the idea is to punish somebody and, you know, presumably make future oil companies or, you know, other corporate entities take action to prevent these things from happening. I mean, if you're talking about not just making people whole, but punishing a wrong, is there, you know, saying that one should follow another, isn't that against the principle of punishment, which is part of the U.S. judicial system?
Well, we're still allowing some punitive damages under this new standard, although you're right, it's much lower. So let's just quickly do some math. The compensatory damages award in this case was somewhere in the neighborhood of about $320 million. So the court could have awarded another $320 million in compensatory damages. That's a lot of money. It's not $2.5 billion, though. And these numbers are so big that it's sort of hard to even really get your mind around them. But I think what the court was doing today was, it was actually really interesting and sort of surprising. They looked at a whole bunch of studies about what the median punitive damages awards have been in many, many civil lawsuits, and they decided that the median was about this one-to-one correlation. That was like around the right standard based on all these previous cases, and they adopted that themselves as their own standard.
Now, who were the dissenters, and what did they say?
The dissenters were Justice Ginsburg and Justice Stevens and Justice Breyer. And they said, court, what are you doing out there making up this one-to-one standard, you know, for every dollar of compensatory damage, another dollar of punitive damages? Like, this isn't your job. Congress never said that this was the right standard. This Exxon case is being decided under federal maritime law. We should look to Congress. We shouldn't be kind of figuring this out for ourselves. And there's this quite pointed comment from Justice Stevens, who wrote the dissent, in which he says, you're ignoring the features of maritime law that are at issue today, and really we should be adhering to a policy of judicial restraint here.
Is this going to have a big impact on other similar lawsuits against corporations?
Well, it's a corner of the law in the sense that we're talking about federal maritime law. We're not talking about state laws involving civil liability. And so it's going to affect future shipping accidents and oil spills. But it's more important as sort of a signal about the court's methodology. I mean, this notion of the court stepping in itself and coming up with this one-to-one rule is kind of novel.
An activist court, kind of ironic. Emily, very quickly, 10 seconds, what are we looking for tomorrow?
Tomorrow, we're mostly looking for the case involving guns and the handgun restriction in Washington, D.C., and whether it is too restrictive under the Second Amendment.
Thanks very much. My guest has been Emily Bazelon of Slate.com. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
This program was produced by Lisa Allison, Jody Avergan, Valerie Lipinski, Nadia Zonis, and Taylor Orsi. We had help today from Paige Cowett. Debbie Daughtry is at the audio controls. Nuala McGovern is the executive producer. I'm Andrea Bernstein, in for Brian Lehrer. I'll be back tomorrow.